All right. Good morning, everyone. Calling to order this, February 23rd meeting of the Preventing Homelessness Committee. We're meeting pursuant to House Rule 10.01. The first order of business is Ms. Schmidt will take the roll.
Morning. Chair Gomez.
Gomez present.
Vice Chair Keeler.
Keeler present.
Keeler present. Lead New Brindley.
Present.
Lead New Brindley present. Davis.
Davis present.
Davis present. Heinrich.
Heinrich present.
Heinrich present. Hollins.
Hollins present.
Hollins present. Hornstein.
Hornstein present.
Hornstein present. Howard.
Howard present.
Howard present. Cagle.
Present.
Cagle present. Petersburg.
Petersburg present.
Petersburg present. Ryer.
Ryer present.
Ryer present. We have a quorum.
Thank you, Ms. Schmidt. Next order of business is approval of the minutes from the February 16th meeting. Representative Keeler, have you had a moment to review those minutes?
I have. So moved, Chair.
So Representative Keeler moves approval of the minutes for February 16th, 2022. Is there any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all those in favor, please unmute briefly and say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? All right, the motion prevails and the minutes for February 16th, 2022 are adopted. So today we're going to hear from two bills authored by Representative Keeler that really focus on young people who are experiencing homelessness and are not connected to their family of origin. And so, you know, we talk about these folks as unaccompanied youth, usually refers to people 16 to 24. And before we get into the bill presentations, we're inviting back to our committee Dr. Stephen Foldis, who you might remember from last year when we passed the local county aid, the Preventing Homelessness Aid. He was kind enough to come and present some of his research about this population to us. And just as a note, when we were working on that county aid last year, my idea was really to focus that on, on kids who were enrolled in school and experiencing homelessness with their families. And we did extend it to include this population of unaccompanied youth 16 to 24. But it's been interesting for me just because, you know, as I've had some conversations with counties, the county aid isn't coming online until next year. So we have had some time to kind of plan up front. And it's been interesting to me that a lot of the counties are really identifying the need as so high in this unaccompanied 16 to 24 year old range that they have been wanting to focus their efforts in that area. And so I'm really thankful that Representative Keeler is bringing forth some other ways for us to invest in these young people when they're at this really important and vulnerable time in their life. I think young adulthood, even if you're surrounded by loving adults, is like really difficult. And so we really like appreciate all the efforts that go into supporting these folks to get a good start and become financially like stable and have the resource, both material and immaterial, kind of that they need to have a good life. So with that, we're going to turn it over to Dr. Foldis. We have a bunch of young people here to share their stories with us. So we're going to try to cut this off move on to the bill at 10:55. But with that, I'd like to welcome Dr. Foldis back to the committee, and if you can introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony, that would be great.
Dr. Foldis, you're muted. Always get you. Good morning, Chair Gomez, Deputy Chair Keeler, and members of the committee. My name is Stephen Foldis. I'm an independent research consultant and an adjunct associate professor of epidemiology and community health at the University of Minnesota. Share my screen with you so that I can proceed. I'm here to describe a compelling business case for public expenditures to prevent youth homelessness, an opportunity that is not well understood. Why? Because until recently, we have been unaware of the comprehensive long-term cost to taxpayers of homelessness. Together with an economist, I conducted a study of these costs for a sample of 1,451 unaccompanied homeless youth in Minneapolis that I'll review very briefly. We estimated the comprehensive taxpayer burden across multiple agencies and over a lifetime, building on an approach developed by Clive Belfield, an economist, and two colleagues. Their groundbreaking research was conducted in 2012 for the House Council for Community Solutions, supported by the Kellogg Foundation. The council asked Belfield two questions. First, how many youth in America, ages 16 to 24, are disconnected from education and employment during these critical growth years? Second, how much is the lifetime cost burden of these youths to taxpayers? We learned for the first time from Belfield and colleagues that there were some 6.74 million disconnected youth in 2011. Fully 17% of all youth in the age range from 16 to 24. Belfield called them, as you see here, opportunity youth. Belfield estimated the aggregate taxpayer burden for each cohort of opportunity youth over their lives from age 16 to 64 to be $1.56 trillion in present value terms. In 2021 dollars, that's nearly $1.9 trillion, the cost of the enormous American Rescue Plan Act passed last year. But unlike the stimulus, these costs roll over each year because each year brings a new cohort of opportunity youth. The cohort of youths, ages 16 to 24, that we studied visited YouthLink in 2011. YouthLink is Minneapolis's largest drop-in center for homeless youth and is a key part of the safety net for nearly 2,000 youth each year who experience homelessness. Like other drop-in centers, YouthLink provides them a safe space off the street, help with basic needs, and case management services to assist with supportive housing, education, and employment, and with seeking eligibility for those publicly funded support programs for which they may be eligible. The cohort of youth in our study was 91% youth of color, and 53% of those over age 18 had yet to complete high school. That makes these youths ground zero for many of our most intractable problems. Racial disparities, the achievement gap in our schools, and poverty and income inequality in our communities. And because of those things, they are examples of the impact of the social determinants of health and problems for public safety. So, while our focus is on a small group of youth, this is a group whose existence has large implications for our society. Using Belfield's approach, we gathered data from many local sources on this cohort's comprehensive costs in 2011. This table shows the comprehensive excess costs to taxpayers for this cohort for 1 year. The bottom line is that total taxpayer costs for this cohort were nearly $30 million expressed in current dollars, or more than $20,000 per person. We transformed these annual costs for our cohort into costs over time in order to estimate the lifetime burden to taxpayers. This arrow represents age in years from 16 to 24, then to 64, where we relied on Belfield's data. As you see below the arrow, the lifetime taxpayer burden for this cohort is over $427 million, or nearly $300,000 per person, as shown above the arrow. Again, these costs are expressed in present value, discounted at 3.5% per year. Next, we examined how much taxpayers spent on all interventions for the cohort in 1 year. We divided all these expenditures into three broad categories. These are expenditures for basic needs, for housing, and for what we call transformative services, which are designed to help youth change their lives. The total for 1 year of interventions was $22.1 million. Now, knowing the taxpayer burden and the cost of interventions, we conducted a break-even analysis. We asked, how many youths would need to become financially self-sufficient at age 20 to offset the annual cost of all interventions for the entire cohort? Here's the answer. All 1,451 youth in the cohort are arrayed on the horizontal axis here, and each adds about $250,000 to the height of the line. That's the present value of what each will cost taxpayers from age 20 to 64. The slope reaches to more than $360 million. We learned that if 89 youths, just 6.1% of the cohort, became self-sufficient at age 20, savings to taxpayers would fund all of the interventions for the entire cohort. So we don't have to succeed with all or even half of these youth to break even. In fact, if we succeed in helping just one in five to end their dependence on publicly funded services, we would generate $50 million in savings to taxpayers above and beyond the annual cost of all services. Now, it's reasonable to ask if we can succeed with 6.1% of these youth. We should acknowledge that these youth face many challenges in turning around their lives. People seldom change as dramatically as assumed in this exercise. The reality is more complex and a lot messier. Dr. Christine Peischer and I are leading a research team in the university's Center for Advanced Studies in Child Welfare, examining what happened to this youth-linked cohort over 6 years. We have some very positive results to share next month, especially about housing and education and the critical role of case managers in achieving desired long-term outcomes. I hope you'll invite me and my team back to describe the policy implications of our latest results. But I want to highlight one finding from our research that is especially relevant today. For our current study, we examined the use over time of MFIP, SNAP, GA, and EA by a slightly smaller subset of these same youths, all of whom lived in Minnesota during this time. As shown here, 57% of the cohort used at least one of these programs at the start of our observation. But 6 years later, use declined to 36% of the group. Now, the focus of our study was comparative, and I'm not showing that result here. Suffice it to say that there could be multiple reasons for this decline, in addition to YouthLink's assistance to these youths. At the start of our observation, more than half of these youth were employed, at least part-time, but most earned only tiny amounts of money then. The most likely explanation for this steady decline in DHS program use is that many of these youths expanded their earned income to the point where they no longer needed these programs. But whatever the causes, there were 257 fewer individuals using any of these public programs. Recall that our break-even analysis suggested that we needed just 89 youths to become financially self-sufficient to fund all of the interventions for the entire cohort. In terms of public dollars, the cohort used nearly $1.3 million in benefits in the first year of observation. 6 years later, the cohort members used about $700,000 in benefits, a 46% decrease. This is why I believe that funding prevention for youth homelessness represents a compelling business case. With such a low break-even, this is a low-risk investment. We can afford to be bold because the lifetime cost of inaction is enormous. So this is an outstanding investment opportunity, not only to help these young people, but to save ourselves as taxpayers a tremendous amount of money. Because of this, we should stop thinking about spending taxpayer dollars on preventing youth homelessness as charity and think of it instead as an essential investment. But while compelling, this opportunity is not simple for two reasons. First, the cost of prevention is immediate and substantial, as in the Homeless Youth Act. While the savings will accrue over many years and are less visible, this is a classic problem with prevention. It is always difficult to quantify expenditures that would have been spent but were not spent. That doesn't mean that the savings are not real. They are real. Thanks to our education. This is analogous. This is a critical window of opportunity to prevent a lifetime of dependency on taxpayer-funded services. Second, the costs I've described are spread over all levels of government and many different agencies, and the savings accrue also variously to all of these entities. This makes it more challenging for any one level of government to justify making a large investment in prevention. The savings will come, but they will be distributed across the budgets of many agencies and parts of government. Now, clearly, this is a compelling business case for investing in prevention in this area, but it requires a visionary group of leaders, leaders who see the big picture and who take the long view to make this investment. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Foldis, for being here and for that presentation. I think that, you know, the sort of analysis that you provide is just such an important way for us to think about the work, especially of this committee, because we are, you know, our charge is preventing homelessness, not just responding. And, you know, so I just think that we have obviously a moral obligation to these young people who are living in our world and in our society and our communities. But I really do appreciate you lifting up what the cost is, the actual cost to our systems of inaction as well, because it's really a compelling way to think about it. And we would love to have you back later when your analysis is completed, maybe after our bill deadlines. If you would indulge us, Representative New Brindley has a question or two for you. So we'll go to her before we go to the bill presentations. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Mr. Foldis, and thanks for coming back. I really enjoy your presentations, and I think they're really informative. I'm hoping you could just clarify some things for me. On your opportunity youth slide, you say I'm just looking for some clarity in definitions. 17% of all youth ages 16 to 64. How are we defining youth, and are we talking about a group of people who enter homelessness as youth and remain until the age of 64? Or what are the definitions here? Where are those numbers coming from?
Those numbers. Yes, thank you. Thank you, Chair Gomez, Representative New Brindley. Those numbers come from the research that was conducted by Clive Belfield and his colleagues, and they're national in scope. The definition is, he defines opportunity youth in the way that others define disconnected youth. And disconnected means not engaged in any serious way in either education or employment during the years from 16 to 24.
Madam Chair.
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you. So is perhaps there's a typo on the slides then. Should those read ages 16 to 24? Rather than 16 to 64. Okay, that makes much more sense. I thought, God bless our 64-year-olds, but I don't always think of them as youth.
I caught that typo this morning.
I appreciate time frame. So thank you for that. And frankly, that 17% number is alarming. Do you have any idea what that number is in Minnesota?
I do not.
Okay.
But I would be very surprised if it were much different.
Yeah. That would be interesting to know, Madam Chair.
Yeah, Representative Lieberman, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My next question, and I apologize because I know we've heard from you before, and I appreciate the work you do. I feel like I have to hear something 10 times before it really sinks in. But with YouthLink, I know that we're talking about, you're talking about a lot of prevention. And I'm wondering, when youth are coming to YouthLink, are they already experiencing homelessness? Or are some of these youth sort of not homeless yet, but they are in need of additional support and services? Who is coming to you through YouthLink?
Dr. Foldis?
Chair Gomez, Representative New Brindley. Yes, these are youth who are experiencing homelessness. But I should say that youth experiencing homelessness are sometimes different than adults. I'm sure you know this. They sometimes have temporary places to stay, sometimes with friends or relatives, and then are experiencing periods when they don't have anywhere to stay but the streets. And so they go in and out of homelessness at times.
Representative New Brindley.
Madam Chair, thank you so much, and thank you. That actually makes a lot of sense. I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit more. You broke down sort of the intervention expenditures, basic needs, housing, and transformative. I'm wondering if you can talk to us just for a moment about what falls into the transformative category. What kinds of interventions, what things are you doing that I assume that this is the category that helps move folks to more permanent self-sustaining in the long run. And so I'm just wondering if you can tell us a little bit about that.
Dr. Foldis?
Chair Gomez, Representative New Brindley. We broadly categorized all of the expenditures that we could find into those three categories. Most of the expenses were for basic needs, such as simply addressing the immediate need for food or for clothing or various other kinds of immediate basic needs. We also categorized expenditures into housing and into transformative services. Transformative services, to your point, included those categories of expenditures for education or for employment training. We also included not regular health services, but mental health and chemical dependency health services, which I think we reasoned are expenditures that are going to help these youth to overcome the immediate issues in their lives and become eligible to make their way more fully in the world.
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Foldis. Do you have an idea, like when you get these youth into YouthLink, Are most of them interested in sort of taking advantage of those transformative services? Or do you have a percentage that are willing to do that? Who is taking advantage of those and how does that work? Does that correlate? I'd be interested to know if that correlates with those numbers that you gave further in the presentation about the youth who stop receiving support from public programs and those who you talked about, you know, the 6.1% number, the break-even number, but it sounds like actually there can be higher success than that. Is there a correlation between those? I assume there's a correlation between those who take advantage of those transformative services.
Dr. Foldis, and if we could finish up pretty quick, and then we do have folks from the link here who can answer more questions when we go to the bills. But Dr. Foldis.
Chair Gomez, Representative New Brindley, that's an excellent question. Thank you. And it actually sets up the research that we would like to share with you next, because that's exactly what we tried to find, the correlations between the extent to which these youth become involved at YouthLink and the outcomes in education, employment, and criminal justice activities, employment in these areas. So indeed, we looked exactly at that question, and we will have next month an extensive set of results to share with you on that critical question.
Thank you, Dr. Foldis. Representative New Brindley, are we okay to move on to the bills, or did you have a last question you wanted to ask?
That's perfect. I would just say thank you, and I hope that Mr. Foldis comes back next month with that information. I think that would be really interesting.
Absolutely. Agree. Looking forward to having you back before the committee, Dr. Foldis. And again, we just, you know, I think you can tell when you come and talk to us, you really get us cranking and thinking about this issue in a way that, you know, that I think is really impactful to our work here. So our sincere gratitude to you for your work and being willing to share it with us so generously here at the Capitol. Thank you.
Chair Gomez, thank you and the representatives for your interest. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. More to come from Dr. Foldis and his team. All right. So next on the agenda, we're moving on to House File 3599, which was referred to us by the Human Services Finance and Policy Committee. We have 30 minutes scheduled for this bill, so we'll try to wrap up and vote, 25 minutes now, by 11:25. Vice Chair Keeler, welcome to your committee. Would you like to move your bill?
I would, Madam Chair.
So Representative Keeler is moving that House File 3599 be re-referred to Human Services Finance and Policy. So 3599 is before us. Representative Keeler, please go ahead and present your bill to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I want us just to start by taking a moment to think about the children in our life. I think we talk a lot about youth in a lot of the spaces, but I kind of want us to really get into that mind frame. I'm a mom, and I know in a lot of spaces we've talked about whether we're moms, grandparents, aunties, or godparents in some way. And so we're all connected to kids. Human trafficking is real. It's real in our state alone. I know that we sat in education policy a couple weeks ago and learned that it's real enough that our MCAs are actually asking a question to our 9th and 11th graders regarding sex trafficking. I want to tell a story to you about the time that I was in Indian education. I had done this job for many years and thought I had amazing relationships with my students. 2 years after graduation, a young woman came back to me and said, "Heather, you totally missed the most horrific part of my life. I left school and I was trafficked every single day and I was home in time for dinner with my family and nobody ever asked if I was okay. This is happening and this is happening in all of our communities to all of our kids." The stats that we learned in education policy said that the 9th and 11th graders that were asked this question, 1.7% of them answered yes. And just geographically, because I think our brains always go to the metro area that these things happen more, I want to bring to your attention that the Northwest part of Minnesota actually had a higher percentage of the answers in that survey. 2.1% of our students answered yes. So this is an issue, and we care about kids, and we care about investing in our next generations. What I also want to highlight to you is that on the AG's website, there's some reports that they did and want to share some of that information with you. That 40% in our state alone, 40% of sex trafficking cases involve a minor. And the average age of that minor is age 13. So I don't know about you, but it is terrifying to me to think that 13-year-olds are being approached in sexual ways to sometimes keep food in their mouth and roofs over their head. Like this is a life or death situation. I'm not going to talk a whole lot more because we have professionals that have been doing this work, and I think we have some testifiers that have actually been a part of this world. What I want to highlight is that we have compassion in this area. We have an opportunity to invest in change in the future, and I hope that you all join me. This is not a partisan issue. This is a next generation issue. So with that, Madam Chair, I'd like to turn it over to my testifiers.
Thank you so much, Representative Keeler. We have some testifiers here. First is Beth Holger, the CEO of The Link, and Angel Otis here on deck. So welcome to the committee, Ms. Holger. If you could just introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
I'm sorry, one moment. We just have to switch the slides from Homeless Youth Act to Safe Harbor. Apologies, we had it wrong on our end maybe.
No worries, we're good.
Madam Chair, while she's doing that.
Representative Keeler.
I didn't even really review the bill. Can I do that real quick? Sorry, that might be helpful while they're getting that up.
That would be great. Thank you, Representative Keeler.
Oh my goodness. Okay, so what the bill does is it provides an allocation of funding for these services, but it also increases an ask, or it has an ask for an exploitation and trafficking study, which I think is really important for us to highlight and talk about, that it's one thing to invest in the services, but like a lot of the questions that we're asking is what services are working, how are they working? We need to do the study and gain the data for us to know exactly how to provide more intentional services and supports for the populations. So that's the overview of the bill, Madam Chair.
Great. Thank you, Representative Keeler. Ms. Holger, are you ready to roll?
Yes, we are. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. We truly appreciate the opportunity to be here today to talk about the very important law of Safe Harbor, and we really appreciate our chief author, Representative Keeler, as well. My name is Beth Holger, and I have the opportunity to be here today representing the Youth Services Network, which is a coalition statewide of homeless youth service organizations, as well as anti-trafficking organizations that are funded through, many of whom are funded through Safe Harbor. And also The Link, which is a Northside nonprofit here that provides services for youth experiencing homelessness, sex trafficking victims, and also juvenile justice alternative programs. We're based in North Minneapolis, however, we serve the 7-county metro area. So I first just wanted to set a few, I know that Representative Keeler gave numbers, which is wonderful. I just wanted to kind of do a few fact checks before we get into the actual Safe Harbor ask, which is, I wanna make sure people understand that both girls and boys and all gender identities are trafficked, and various studies have shown that. Oftentimes, unfortunately, the stereotype is it only happens to girls, but unfortunately it does happen to every gender identity. I also wanted to point out that trafficking victim survivors absolutely can be of every race. It can happen in every community, and it absolutely does. As Representative Keeler said, it happens in rural areas, tribal communities, suburban areas, and inner city. However, we continue to see Black youth, Native youth, and LGBTQ youth overrepresented among youth victim survivors. A lot of times we get asked, and throughout my career, I've had so many people say, this does not happen in Minnesota. It only happens in foreign countries. It doesn't happen here. This can't happen to our children. I will tell you another big myth is that it only happens in other countries and that all trafficking victims are foreign-born. That absolutely is not true. The vast majority of victim survivors are born here, raised here. They are our Minnesota children and youth. And I don't. I know that YouthLink, Dr. Foldis spoke to the 16 to 24 age range, but honestly, that's what who YouthLink serves. The Homeless Youth Act serves youth. We serve youth as young as 10 that are experiencing homelessness. So 10 to 24, and Safe Harbor, same thing, 10 to 24. So we see victims, like Representative Keeler said, the average age of entry into trafficking is between 12 and 14. And we absolutely see that at the link. We have several 13, 14-year-old victims in our shelter right now. So what we see is very young youth. We see parents, caregivers, family members selling or trading their children, which I know no one wants to talk about, but that absolutely happens in our state. We also see youth who are experiencing homelessness or who have run away from home, targeted by traffickers and sexual exploiters, wanting young people to trade sex or sexual acts for rent or a place to live. We see people seducing, kind of using seduction, coercion, and grooming, and then mixed with very violent tendencies, abuse, and threats. To lure young people into sex trafficking. And again, keep in mind they're 12, 13, 14-year-olds. And then also we see false advertising for modeling, acting, dancing opportunities that turn out to be completely different than what they are. And then we also see peer recruitment. So traffickers know that that adolescent brain development, peer-to-peer, is a high influence, right? And so traffickers get young people working for them to recruit other youth. And then we also see young people recruiting other youth because they've experienced such high levels of trauma in their life. They actually think, oh, I'm trying to help somebody because I'm, you know, they can come with me and they can actually get some of their need, quote unquote, needs met, like maybe a place to sleep or some food. So sometimes it's absolutely unintentional as well. I want to make sure that's known. And then last but not least, everybody probably knows this, but the internet has really, over the course of the time I've worked with victims, survivors, has really changed things. So we are seeing a lot of recruitment being done online over the internet. And it's really unfortunate, but there's a lot of the grooming, seduction, things like that, that are absolutely occurring over chat rooms and different internet sites. So just want to make sure people understand it's absolutely happening here to our children and youth. The other thing I want to say, though, is there is hope. There is hope. So what happened was many of us, myself included, but many young people who are victim survivors, many people, other service providers in the anti-trafficking movement, family partnership, Breaking Free, et cetera, we have been at this working to try to make change for victims for a very long time. And for a long time, people didn't believe us, thought it wasn't as big of an issue, but then very thankful that a woman by the name of Marilyn Carlson Nelson, who is a global business leader, philanthropist, and leader in this field, frankly, really stuck her neck out for the Radisson hotel chains that they owned to train their staff. And once her and her family kind of started taking a global stand on the issue, we were really able to make more progress. They also worked in coordination with the Women's Foundation. A big thank you to the Women's Foundation for doing a huge campaign called Girls Are Not for Sale. So once that happened and other lobbyists and other organizations chimed in, we were able to finally pass the Safe Harbor Law in 2011, which decriminalizes prostitution offenses for youth under the age of 18. It recognizes youth as victims and survivors of a crime instead of teenage prostitutes who are getting arrested and placed in juvenile detention just to get re-released to their traffickers. And it also amends the Child Protection Code to include sexual exploitation and trafficking, because before this time, it wasn't even seen as a form of abuse or child, you know, abuse. The other thing that happened was we developed a whole new response then statewide. Minnesota was on the forefront, one of the very first states to do this, and I'm very proud of that. And we were able to create a whole new response through a multidisciplinary committee from Department of Public Safety, Department of Health, and Department of Human Services that created a interdisciplinary committee called the Safe Harbor Committee. And then also during that time, I was able to receive a two-year Bush Fellowship to work with survivors and a lot of different stakeholders to help design and name the No Wrong Door response. So it was very much many people involved with that. So I want to say this is an amazing new response for our state. I mean, it's been around a little bit, but still new. We have all of these, a continuum of support for young people from Safe Harbor Regional Navigators, which are basically advocates across the state localized to their region, specialized street outreach, specialized services such as mental health therapy, legal services, and more. We have specialized emergency shelter, host homes, and housing, a variety of housing that's funded through Safe Harbor. But it's definitely not enough, which we'll get into in a minute. Just a couple of grantee examples of how that money gets spent. And a young center in St. Paul offers culturally specific case management to Native American victim survivors. Lutheran Social Services in Brainerd offers a specialized foster care program for trafficking victims called Saving Grace. 180 Degrees in the East Metro offers the host site for the East Metro Regional Navigator and an emergency shelter for girls called Brittany's Place. And the Link, we host the West Metro Regional Navigator along with a variety of Safe Harbor supportive services, street outreach, and emergency shelter and housing. And this is just some pictures. This is a picture of myself and an outreach partner, Tanji. This happened to be during the Super Bowl when we did a lot of increased street outreach for trafficking victims and increased services during that time. And then also, I want to say there's so many partners in this. We really appreciate all of it from government, private, faith-based. So this is some donations our shelter received from the Mall of America, which was really helpful, of furniture and baby items and things like that. And so what our ask to you today is, and then I'm going to turn it over to our testifiers who are much more powerful than me, and I'm so honored to be here with them today. What our ask from you, Services Network, is for you all and our state to make a genuine commitment to reducing and ending the sexual exploitation of our children and youth. We want to do this, and we know we can do it by asking for an increased investment of $20 million for Safe Harbor. $9 million of that would be for street outreach, emergency shelter, and housing, additional beyond what we have because we have to turn away youth all the time. And then another $9 million for Safe Harbor supportive services and an additional $2 million for additional regional navigators. And those amounts are actually the amounts that were requested by grantees across the state to the Departments of Health and Human Services. So we know absolutely that there's a need for those funding sources. And then we also want, one difficult thing is that we do not have a prevalence study. We get asked all the time how many youth are and children are sex trafficked in the state or how many adults. We don't know. I mean, we do have the Minnesota State survey data, which is great, but that's only for two grades. It's only for the youth that were in school at the time, and oftentimes trafficked youth aren't necessarily going to school regularly and also may or may not feel comfortable answering questions on a government survey. So that's very much an under estimate and count. So we would like $300,000 in one-time funds to do a prevalence study. We know that similarly to investments, as Dr. Folda said, investing in homeless youth works, and so does investing in trafficked youth. And so in the state, the Department of Health did a Safe Harbor evaluation and found that there was just a little bit under 1,300 youth served through the Safe Harbor Network grantees between 2017 and 2019. Of those, 97% reported positive changes after receiving Safe Harbor services, 100% felt more prepared to reach their educational goals, and 89% felt more prepared to support themselves in a financially safe way. That is incredible. And those are self-reports from young people. The other thing is, similarly to Dr. Folda's study, Dr. Martin with the University of Minnesota URAC did a cost-benefit study in 2012 on providing services and interventions for trafficked youth. And what that study found was that there's a 34-to-1 return on investment. For every dollar the state invests, there's a $34 return on that. So absolutely, this is cost intervention is a good investment as well. But more importantly, it is the right thing to do. And I think I'm going to pass on my examples just because I know we're short, a little bit short on our time, and I want to make sure to give these amazing testifiers time. But this is what it looks like. This is what it looks like once a young person gets out of being trafficked, gets into a safe place, feels loved and cared for in an appropriate way, and has the opportunity to achieve their education, mental health, and all kinds of goals that they want to have. This is what it looks like. And there's some young people up in the top corner at our shelter. actually all these pictures are from that. So with that, what I will do is turn it over to the Madam Chair. Sorry.
That's okay. Thank you, Ms. Holger. Appreciate it. We're going to go to our testifiers now. We want to give you guys time, but you know we have to kind of keep it tight because we have to move on to another bill also. But Angel or Angel Otis, if you're here, you could just say hi, introduce yourself for the record, and go ahead with your testimony. Thank you for being with us.
Yep, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Angel Otis, and I work with The Link. I just wanted to start off with my experience. So I started at 11 years old in the foster care system, in the juvenile justice system at 12, and then I was actually exposed to sexual exploitation and sex trafficking at the age of 13. I didn't even notice myself that I was getting sex trafficked or exploited until 17 years old, and that's when I received my first services. So coming with the experience that I have, I just think that a lot of the youth that are specifically exploited and trafficked, we tend to slip through the cracks. The system might focus on other issues that we have, which was, for me, example, like the juvenile justice system. I had other things going on. And so I just feel like we need more direct service for sexual exploitation and sex trafficking, a lot of harm reduction specifically for that, because I didn't get to see that. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Angel. Thank you for being with us and for sharing your experience. It means so much to us and to our committee members to hear from you. And it's, you know, it's just really moving and brave of you to be with us. We know it's hard sometimes to like be in one of these forums, but we really, really appreciate your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, we have Serenity Carroll joining us. Serenity, if you could say hi, introduce yourself for the record, and go ahead with your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Hi, my name is Serenity Carroll. I'm 19 years old. I currently live in Duluth, Minnesota. I grew up in the foster care system and experienced a lot of abuse. There were not many placements that would take me. Growing up without support or seeing healthy relationships, I found myself in a very abusive relationship. In 2019, my social worker placed me with Soul House, and I began accessing Lifehouse services. I was living at Soul House for a few different times while I struggled through my abusive relationship. In 2020, I found out I was pregnant, needed a stable place to live. I moved back into Soul House and then transitioned into an apartment at Northern Lights. I was thankful for being able to access basic needs to the youth center when I was running low on items and that I needed for me or my daughter. I'm now living in my own apartment and began attending college this spring semester. I'm raising my beautiful and healthy 10-month-old daughter. I'm able to set boundaries in my current relationship because of the groups I attended while at Soul House. I believe it's important to continue supporting programs like Lifehouse to help youth that are in the similar situations I was in.
Thank you so much, Serenity. Thanks to you and your little one for being with us and for sharing today. It means a lot to us, and we really appreciate it. Thank you. We have one more testifier, Caitlin Orgon. Sorry if I'm saying your name wrong. If you could introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Caitlin Orgon. I'm an assistant program director at Evergreen Youth and Family Services up in Bemidji. Evergreen started in 1977 as a shelter for minors, and we currently have two different Safe Harbor programs. Our shelter is certified to serve Safe Harbor youth, and we also have a transitional living program where youth are living independently in their own apartments. I'm incredibly grateful to be speaking with you today, as sex trafficking and exploitation are commonly thought of as a metro issue, and we've talked a little bit about that already. But Beltrami County has one of the highest rates of poverty and the highest rate of children being removed from the home in the state. And we know that poverty and involvement with the foster care system are major risk factors for youth who are being targeted by traffickers and exploiters. And late 2018, we started our housing program at Evergreen. And since then, we've housed 26 youth survivors of sexual exploitation and provided supportive services for dozens of other Safe Harbor youth. Our average Safe Harbor program receives about 30 client referrals a year, but we currently only have funding to house 4 of those youth at any one time. American Indians make up about 20% of Beltrami County's population. However, approximately 55% of Evergreen's Safe Harbor clients identify as American Indian. We cannot talk about sex trafficking and exploitation without recognizing the historical trauma and systems of oppression that our nation's first people have endured. At Evergreen, we also see that 67% of our Safe Harbor youth have been involved in the foster system. On average, youth are between the age of 19 and 20 when they first contact our Safe Harbor program, but we are receiving more referrals for minors. In the last year, we've housed 2 17-year-olds. One of them has a child. These youth were sexually exploited. They had no support from their families, and county social services were not willing to intervene. I would have never believed that scenario to be true until I saw it with my own eyes, and I continue to see it happen. The truth of the matter is many of the youth who have been sexually exploited in Minnesota do not simply fall through the cracks. They're ignored, and oftentimes they're pushed through the cracks, which is unacceptable. I've received referrals from county social workers in several jurisdictions, not just the metro, not just Beltrami County, who refuse to intervene when a child has disclosed sexual exploitation. This is an issue across the entire state. County social workers don't understand the dynamics of exploitation, or they don't have an appropriate placement for the youth. So why do we need increased investments for youth who have been exploited? The answer is simple to me. It's our responsibility to protect the most vulnerable members of our communities. The state of Minnesota truly has led the way across the country in creating legislation and services for youth who have been trafficked, but we have a long way to go. Our youth are resilient and passionate. They want to heal. They want to work on their education. And many of them want to go into helping professions, and they're strong advocates for themselves and for other vulnerable members of our community. We owe them every opportunity to thrive.
Thank you very much, Ms. Oakton, for being with us today. So I don't have any public testifiers who've asked to speak, but I'm going to hold on a second here, see if anybody raises their hand. Also, I'll note that members received some written testimony that's posted to the hearing notice on our webpage. Not seeing any public testifiers, are there member questions or comments on this bill before we go to Representative Keeler for some closing comments? All right, I'm not seeing any member hands. If I'm missing anything, please let me know, Sean or Robin. Representative Keeler, did you have any closing comments for us?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to confirm, I don't see any other hands either. I do just want to highlight one of the changes that we will make, hoping that we pass this through with the funding piece. We noticed it this morning without time to make an author's amendment, but the funding allocation in Section 4 is actually $10 million per year ongoing. So I just want to make sure that we're reading that and seeing that correctly. We will make those adjustments as we move to the next committee. We unfortunately just caught it too late, so want to be transparent in that. But again, after the messages that we've heard, the data that we hear, and the reality that is in front of us, I encourage us all to know and find the value in investing in this effort, and like I said earlier, investing in our next generations, as we saw here, this is impacting more than just the child that we're helping. It's actually impacting their family and their next generations. So I encourage you all, it's a good bill, it's a good effort, and it's something that will impact all of our communities positively. Kilamae, thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Representative Keeler. So hearing no further discussion, Representative Keeler will renew her motion that House File 3599 be re-referred to Human Services, Finance, and Policy. And the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Gomez.
Gomez, aye.
Gomez, aye. Vice Chair Keeler?
Keeler, aye.
Keeler, aye. Lead New Brindley? Lead New Brindley? David?
David votes aye.
David, aye. Heinrich?
Heinrich, aye.
Heinrich, aye. Holland?
Holland's aye.
Holland, aye. Hornstein?
Hornstein, aye.
Hornstein, aye. Howard? Howard? Cagle?
Aye.
Cagle, aye. Petersburg?
Petersburg, aye.
Petersburg, aye. Ryer?
Ryer, aye.
Ryer, aye. We have 9 ayes.
There being 9 ayes and 0 nays, the motion passes, and House File 3599 is on its way to Human Services, Finance, and Policy. Thank you, everyone. Next up, Representative Keeler has another bill in front of us, House File 3661. It was referred to this committee, this division, from the Human Services Committee. Representative Keeler, would you like to move your bill?
I would, Madam Chair.
Excellent. Representative Keeler moves that House File 3661 be re-referred to Human Services, Finance, and Policy. House File 3661 is before the committee. Representative Keeler, please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. sometimes in the legislature, we're empaths, and so the fact that we all just saw that last bill important was a little emotional for me. So let me regroup. We're looking at House File 3661, which is a bill authorizing the use of funds for our Youth Homeless Act grant, and also an inclusion of funding for a one-time allocation for a study around parenting and youth. When we look at a lot of the data and a lot of the breakdowns, this is one of the areas that we just don't have a lot of data, but we know that this is impactful. So again, like the last bill, it's just the one-time investment to have this study so that we can really get adequate data so that we can make sure that we're serving the best that we can in this community. What I do want to highlight, and I'll pass it on, is that this effort was actually started in 1999 by the frontline workers themselves. And I think that that's really important to highlight in general when we're looking at these efforts, is when our frontline workers who work day to day at grassroots organizations with the individuals that we're talking about, their voices matter. And this program was developed and has been growing and implemented and has impacted many lives. And so it's an increase in investment because this issue is increasing across the state. And then again, looking at our pregnant and parenting study. But some of the services that are provided through this funding, just really briefly, and then we'll pass it over to testifiers, is homeless prevention. We talk a lot about that in this space, is that what are we doing to actually prevent homelessness? And so this funding does that. We also do street outreach, which is so important. It's relationships, finding people where they're at, rather than always having services that you need to come to us. So the street outreach is so vitally important in this work. Drop-in centers, post homes, and so much more. And so with that, Madam Chair, I would highlight this same thing, Section 4 appropriation in this bill. As we were looking at it this morning, it's asked for $50 million, but the reality is it's $25 million per year, $50 biennium ongoing. Those adjustments would be made if we pass through and move to the next committee. Again, thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to discuss this today. We'll pass it over to our testifiers.
Thank you very much, Vice Chair Keeler. So we have a few testifiers signed up. First, we'll go back to Ms. Holger, CEO of The Link. I apologize for mispronouncing your name like 3 times earlier in the committee. Welcome back.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. Please do not worry about that at all. Thank you so much again, Representative Keeler. Wonderful, wonderful introduction and just wonderful leadership on this issue. Again, my name is Beth Holger. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here. and I am here with my colleague, esteemed colleague and co-leader, Jordan Johnson from Lifehouse in Duluth. And we're here to talk a little bit about the Homeless Youth Act. Oh, oops. I'm sorry. Okay. So as Representative Keeler, it was written by frontline youth workers, youth with lived experience back in 1999. If you do the math, we have been coming to you for 23 years at this point, and we will keep coming to you until it's fully funded, by the way. But it was written truly by the true experts, youth themselves, frontline workers, you know, outreach workers. I'm so honored to have been a part of this journey. And it includes inclusive definitions of youth and young families that don't limit who can receive help. The reason why we had to do our own Homeless Youth Act was because oftentimes what we were hearing were false narratives of, oh, there's not really youth aren't really homeless in our state. They're all taken care of by child protection or their parents. They're not really youth homeless. Like, there's not youth out there who are experiencing homelessness, and that's absolutely not true. The other misnomer and false narrative is that there's enough money to support them. If you come to any of our agencies on any daily basis, you will see that that absolutely is not true. So we decided to kind of, in a very grassroots fashion, come together and write the Homeless Youth Act. And we had the help of an attorney, Rich Hooks Wayman, at that time, who worked at Streetworks. And it includes, the other issue is a lot of the different funding streams or government mechanisms, some of them really include definitions that are not inclusive of youth who are experiencing homelessness. And so it's really difficult, and we can speak to this, but even earlier in some of the testimony, youth who are couch hopping are in dangerous situations and are also experiencing homelessness, just to make that known. And so this definition of youth homelessness is based on reality and makes complete sense. It's very inclusive, along with the definition of young families. It's not restrictive. It can serve single parents, co-parents, and all kinds of families, straight or heterosexual couples. It also includes funding for the full continuum of services. So we don't want to pit one program against another because all of them are important. We need homeless prevention, street outreach, drop-in, shelter, housing. We need all of it in order to work on this issue. So it includes, it also provides flexibility for innovation and also for culturally specific services. Currently, there's 38 grantees that are funded across the state through the Homeless Youth Act from rural areas, tribal communities, suburban and inner city areas, because youth homelessness happens everywhere. And I will turn it over to Jordan for this, if that's okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jordan Johnson. I'm the executive director of Lifehouse up here in Duluth, Minnesota. Thank you for having us this morning. And I'll just continue on, but this bill also really kind of helps support kind of homeless prevention work, our drop-in centers, our emergency shelters, and our housing, rapid rehousing opportunities or permanent supportive housings. Just to give you an example up here at Lifehouse, we have our drop-in center is the hub of where we kind of connect with young people. And so we have this kind of vision. We've been doing this work for over 30 years, have this vision that no young person should ever be left alone, homeless or uncared for on the streets at any one time. And so if we're thinking around kind of the work that we do, we believe that comprehensive supportive services is the kind of way to go. We don't have any cost or any insurance for our young people. And this funding specifically supports our kind of drop-in youth center where we serve over 800 unduplicated youth annually. Those numbers are still continuing to rise. Our loft, the emergency shelter, is located directly above our drop-in center, so there's easy access. Work really diligently to ensure there's reduced barriers to all our services we offer. And then it also supports our permanent housing, supportive housing units throughout the community and area. So I'll turn it back to Beth.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Next on the list is Ginny Hissam. I'm not exactly certain how to pronounce your name, but if you could introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for this opportunity to be here today and hear our pleas. As noted, my name is Jimmy Hissom. I'm the supervisor of Safe Zone Drop-In Center. We are the only drop-in center in Ramsey County that serves homeless youth. So just to state that, we've been very busy recently. We do serve ages 14 to 24, and certainly that age range does not even fully encompass all the visitors that come to our space. We do have to turn people away on both end of that spectrum of the age. I've been with face-to-face in Safe Zone for about 2.5 years. I began as an advocate, meeting basic needs in the space, providing meals, checking people in at the front desk, getting hygiene supplies, things of that nature. Then I moved up to be a case manager, which I really, really enjoyed. I was able to provide rental assistance, help set goals, identify strengths of young people, which I would say would be one of the most important pieces of case management, is just getting young people to realize that they can make a positive impact and that they do have power to share and positive things to share with our society. And then for the past year, I've had the pleasure of being the supervisor of the drop-in, still being able to provide direct service to young people, still could be called case management, but then also being able to support and lead others to provide those services and guide them in delivering our services based on our 9 guiding principles. That all being said, my relationship with Safe Zone actually begins far before 2019 when I began working here. Way back in 1997, I was actually a client. I received a lot of various forms of support from Safe Zone. The basics, of course, like meals, bus tokens, medical and mental health support, that kind of thing. But probably most important was the relationship I developed with my case manager. Her name is Skye. And she was incredibly supportive. She never gave up on me. She always understood why I maybe made some not so good choices for myself and helped me to realize why I was making those choices for myself as well. And then guided me to make different choices when similar situations presented themselves again in the future. This was long ago, of course, before the Homeless Youth Act was even existed, before our 9 guiding principles were established. Safe Zone was kind of scrappy back then, didn't look like much, but definitely was able to still make huge impacts in all of our lives. There was an incentive program at that time to graduate high school by a certain date. So the first 10 people that signed up and graduated would receive $100. I thought, hey, I'll give it a try. And I actually made it. And so that surprise, I was surprised because I only finished 10th grade traditionally through high school. So that really definitely made, open up a lot of doors for me employment-wise. And frankly, I don't know if I would have ever gone back because at that time I had given birth to a child. And so being a single mother, it was hard to kind of make that dedication to go back and do that. Face-to-face also connected me to prenatal care and different parenting information and support of that nature as well, which was tremendously important to me at the time. My daughter is now 22 and lives mostly independently. Many of the living skills I learned from Safe Zone I was able to share with her, which is great. As she neared her age to graduate high school, I decided it was time for me to finally do and be what I wanted to be when I grew up, which was come back to youth service work, something that made such a positive impact to me. So I decided to go to college online while working and made the career transition of my dreams, really. It was and still is so meaningful to me to now work for and get to be here and speak on behalf of an organization that empowered me to do something with my life. Which actually leads us to why we're here today, to present why increased investment in the Homeless Youth Act is, and actually in the youth of our future, needs to happen. We need to not only increase current services to meet the increase in demand in not only numbers, but varying needs of youth for today's problems, but we also need to expand our services so that we can meet the changing needs of our youth. Obviously, with the pandemic this last year, things have presented themselves in different ways that haven't come up before. Empowering us with this additional funds will also give us better quality control on how we deliver the services, allowing us to abide by our 9 guiding principles, keeping young people's whole beings at the forefront of our decisions as we deliver the services. As already highlighted, some of the services include street outreach, drop-in centers, employment, internship and development is extremely important, getting young people ready to be in the workplace. And while we have the space and capacity to teach and guide people essentially how to be acceptable to society standards, it's not going to always be received well outside of here. And so we have that opportunity to make this impact at this time in their lives. Also mentioning case management services, we have different support groups covering anger management, healthy relationships, how to handle their emotions as they come up. I know we've discussed age of what a youth experiencing homelessness is. Many times the compounded traumas that our young people experience really delay their development to be age appropriate to what other people might consider legal adults. They're not going to be able to have the capacities to manage their emotions and cope with all their traumas in ways that allow them to still go to work and manage making appointments and following up on all of their tests that they need to. We definitely need more shelters, more family shelters. We've talked about parenting youth. I've had to turn away and sadly not find shelter many nights for parenting youth. That's an extremely underserved portion of our community. Additionally, that transitional and transformative care is extremely important to ensure once they gain housing and become independently relatively successful, that they can maintain that after that. And so being able to provide that wraparound care that once they get over that hump of a crisis, we can ensure they don't go back into being unsheltered and keep their housing and support them through those things that come up after that. A lot of times people that experience many traumas over time, once they become settled and don't have to worry about a crisis right in that moment, is when all their feelings come flooding out. And then all of a sudden, everything looks on paper to be great. They've got housing, they've got a job, maybe they're in some counseling. Okay, it looks great on paper, but they need that supportive guidance to keep all of that going and to keep that momentum. Because once those feelings hit, it's really hard to keep that going. And I can say that for myself as well, having experienced that. Additionally, I would say that housing uncertainty, food insecurity, all of those things cause stress and chronic conditions that develop. Just the generational trauma of most of the people that we serve in and of itself, even if they weren't experiencing anything today, is enough to help hinder their success and limit their potentials and achieving their potentials. I would say that I'm a 25-year demonstration of how these transformative services can work. I went through maybe 15 years or so of doing jobs that I felt like, you know, I had to do to make, you know, ends meet and support my daughter and meet her needs. And I, again, will say I'm very grateful to have gotten to a point to make that transition into being here and giving back. Seeing the results are immeasurable. They really have no dollar value. However, this $50 million additional funds could do so much and make such an impact. Seeing the change and expansion of services since I was a young person now, since the introduction of the Homeless Youth Act, I would love to see that continue. Factors such as increase in numbers, demand in services, increase in changing needs, and of course, not to mention the increased cost of every single thing that we survive on right now, is justifiable to meet this investment increase in the Homeless Youth Act to serve our youth. That being said, I feel like we should never have to turn youth away due to a lack of funds. It's inexcusable, should not be in our vocabulary at this point, not here in Minnesota, not anywhere. With that, I would like to say thank you again, Madam Chair, and members of the committee, for hearing our pleas. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Hissom. Thank you for your work and thanks for being with us. We appreciate hearing from you. Finally, LaRonda Lake is joining us from the link. Welcome back to the committee, Ms. Lake. It's great to see you again. Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for your time. I am LaRonda Lake. I'm a youth specialist at LinQuisp, and respectfully, you know, correct, was it for this? Yes. Couch hopping is definitely considered homeless due to the fact that we would have to be leaving the next day after having a night of, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? Of sexual activity, basically, just for that one night of having to stay at a stranger's house. And it was completely unsafe for me and as well as other homeless youth. So a little bit about myself was I was in foster care from the age of 6. I aged out at 18 or 19 years old. And from there, it was more trauma on top of more trauma from leaving an abuse and, you know, not having enough food or neglecting everything from my mom to being homeless and having to see people beat up in these homeless shelters and just, you know, sexually abused, all sorts of stuff. And this is what we face as homeless youth. And in order to, you know, prevent that from happening, I feel like this fund will really help us because it's a starter to and a chance to see that somebody believes in us enough to give us funding so we can have our own places and grow from there. Many a times we're not heard enough and we're just basically put to the back burner because they don't believe we have much to say or more to offer, but we can't offer much if we don't have a start. They held they held an apartment for me. And I moved there from March 15, 2017 to 2019. But before that, I was in a coma due to my health of being homeless. I was in a coma until November 29th to January 1st. So I had to learn how to eat again. I had to learn how to walk again and use the bathroom. Like, my health was really bad, and not just my physical health, but my mental health. And that's kind of what led to that situation. I didn't feel heard. I didn't feel like anyone understood me. I was tired of being in the streets all the time. And I'm like, when is my chance going to come? When am I going to get housing for myself? Like, you know, I would automatically assume that leaving foster care that I would have something set up for myself. And that wasn't the case at all. And basically, I was thrown out in the street, like I said, but that's what led me to my coma. I did, I overdosed. And yeah, I did that to myself. And that's sad because I was like, is this what my life will be like? I was miserable. And being sexually abused and moving place to place to place. And so I started to see a therapist, which she reached out to the Lindquist because I had already spoken to someone at Salvation Army, and come to find out the lady moved and she did not communicate to the next person. Like, this person, LaRonda Lake, needs housing. And she's been on the wait list. We didn't know for months what was going on. So I was like, you know, I felt kind of hopeless, like, dang, another place didn't hear me out. I wasn't heard. So I ran into a really good therapist, and come to find out, while I was in my coma, she had got in touch with the Lindquist. And Lindquist actually held my bed for months. And once I actually moved in, I was able to come up, basically. Here's my chance. What do I need after my chance? I start to go back to school because, you know, me being in foster care for that long, they lost my ninth grade records. I was always on the move. I've never stayed in a place for more than a year. So me not staying in a place, they were like, well, where's your records at? How am I a U.S. citizen in, you know, United here? And you lost, everything is on file. You lost my ninth grade records. So that held me back from graduating on time, and they didn't tell me until I was in 12th grade. So I finally got my GED. There was a less stress added being able to have housing. And then from there, you know, I got a job, personal care assistance. I had begun to work there. You know, I started to really come up, and then that's where I took my chance. I took it up. from there, and I really succeeded with my life, I feel like. I was just talking last year or the year before that with you guys about starting my own family. And, well, I finally got my little one. I'm married and stuff like that. So that's basically where my chance took me, is up from there. And I believed in myself, and I'm glad somebody else believed in me to, you know, continue on. But without that chance, who knows where I would have been at. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Lorenda. Thank you, Ms. Lake, for joining us. I don't think we got to meet your little one last time, but he's beautiful. Congratulations. And just our appreciation to you for sharing your story with us. I don't see any public testifiers, but I'll give it a minute to see if any hands go up before we go to member questions or comments. I'm not seeing anyone, so Representative Petersburg, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first of all, I just want to say I think all of us really believe in the goals of the programs that are out there, and we want to do whatever we can for the youth. But I also have a responsibility to be accountable for the funding and so forth. So if I could ask a few questions just financially, I'll ask them all three, and then somebody can answer them. What is the current budget for these particular programs is number one, if you could remind us of that. This is another $50 million for additional programs and services. We've heard a little bit about what needs are still out there, but my final question is, how did we arrive at the $50 million? What basis do we have that this actually is going to be sufficient, et cetera, and what is the needs going to be into the future? And if you could answer those questions, I appreciate that, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. I don't know if Vice Chair Keeler or Ms. Holger wants to jump in on that. Please feel free, either of you.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I can start with the first question, and then I can pass it over for the second question. Representative Petersburg, the original allocation right now is set for $11.2 million per biennium, and the ask is increasing to 25. And from what I've gathered in my research and conversations, we do have the data that shows that the increase to 50 is because that is the amount of asks that we were not able to award. But I'm actually going to pass it over, I think, to Ms. Holger, if she can talk a little bit more about it specifically. And did you say you had three questions? I only caught two.
Madam Chair, the other question was just what are the additional things that need to be done? But that's kind of been spelled out, and that's going to take too long to get into that. So first and last question is probably sufficient.
Great. Thanks, Rep. Petersburg. Ms. Holger?
Sure. So what I can first of all, sorry. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I've just been practicing this with the young people, and sorry about that. Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Petersburg for the question, and Representative Keeler. We actually, for the Homeless Youth Act, we have very good data right now on the Wilder Research Center does estimates every 3 years of how many young people are experiencing homelessness on any given night in Minnesota. And again, that's largely between the ages of 10 and 24. So we have these, and it's 4,879 unaccompanied youth on the streets, like tonight. And then we also know the number of current shelter beds and housing units we have that are designated for youth and young families across the state and how much it costs to operate them. And so what we did was we did it's not, you know, I'm not Dr. Foldis. I am a youth work professional, not a research scientist, but we did an estimate or an analysis of that data that we do have to determine what the cost would be to expand out the services to support every single young person so that we don't have any youth on the street every night. And that the whole total price tag comes just shy of $1 billion over 2 years. But we also know that we can't, we actually thought about asking for the full billion, but then we really thought about our capacity. And we have to get shelters for minors licensed, for example, and that process takes about a year. We have to hire staff in a labor shortage. And so what we decided to do was, even though the need is 500, you know, million a year, we're going to start by asking for an increase of 25 million towards that. And I can tell you, we absolutely can put it to use, you know, right away. We've got youth on waiting lists for our shelter and housing programs at the link, and I'm sure other providers too. So that's how the number got set for the Homeless Youth Act. For Safe Harbor, we had a great meeting with our partners at the State Department of Health, as well as DHS OEO. And I just have to give a big, if I can, a big shout out to them. They are just really incredible partners, do grant making amazingly. And what they did was they were able to give us the data on the amount of requested funds for Safe Harbor, Supportive Services, Regional Navigators, and Street Outreach Shelter and Housing. And so what we did was
I'm sorry.
$20 million ask from that.
Okay, we have to get to a vote in the next 3 minutes. I'm sorry, I don't mean to cut you off.
No, please do. That's okay. Thank you very much, Madam Chair and Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. Rep. Petersburg, are we good? We want to hear from
I'm more confused now because now I heard $500 million and $500 million versus $50 million. So at this point, I guess I'm going to have to be a no because I'm not clear exactly what the request or what the need is. But thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. I mean, I think that the $500 million was based on the Wilder research, which we will be sure to share with you. But certainly you vote how you'd like. Let's Representative Hollins, did you have a quick comment before we move to a vote?
It's fine. I was just going to thank the testifiers because you all are so brave and so amazing, and we just love you. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. We all want to echo that. So Representative Keeler, is it okay if we just move on to a vote?
Yeah.
Representative Keeler Representative Keeler is renewing her motion that House File 3661 be re-referred to Human Services, Finance, and Policy. The clerk will take the roll. Chair is an aye.
Chair Gomez, aye. Vice Chair Keeler?
Keeler, aye.
Keeler, aye. Lee DeBrinley? Lee New Brindley. David?
David's no.
David's nay. Heinrich?
Heinrich no.
Heinrich no. Hollins?
Hollins aye.
Hollins aye. Bernstein?
Bernstein aye.
Bernstein aye. Howard?
Howard aye.
Howard aye. Cagle?
Cagle aye.
Cagle, aye. Petersburg?
Petersburg, no.
Petersburg, no. Ryer?
Ryer, aye.
Ryer, aye. We have 7 ayes and 3 nays.
There being 7 ayes and 3 nays, the motion passes in House File 3661, is re-referred to Human Services, Finance, and Policy. Just final word. You know, this is why we're here. This is why our communities asked us to come here. We get to decide whether to take action in these moments or not. And, you know, I'm an empath too. And Ms. Lake, Ms. Otis, Ms. Carroll, Ms. Hissom, your stories are going to stay with us and on our hearts as we do this work. And so just, again, we are so appreciative for the vulnerability that you brought and the generosity in sharing yourselves and your stories with our committee so that we can make the best decisions possible for the people and especially the young people of Minnesota. Thank you. Thank you so much. We really appreciate you. And our next meeting will be Wednesday, March 2nd. And with that, we are adjourned.